The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, listener, it's Zach Harper, Amin El-Hassan, and Anthony Mays of Cinephobe. You may be asking yourself, what is Cinephobe? Amin, would you like to fill in the people?
Cinephobe is the podcast where Zach and I watch movies that are poorly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and try to ascertain.
We're trying to ascertain?
Yes.
Okay.
Ascertain. Whether or not they're accurately poorly rated, or maybe they didn't get a fair shake. Cinephobe, produced by this guy, Anthony Mays.
Hey, that's me. I produced this show. I also watch the movies, even though that wasn't included in the description, and I also ascertain. This month is...
Whoa!
Oh, Maze, why'd you say that? Supercharge it. So that this promo can remain evergreen.
I feel like explaining a little bit more.
In 60 seconds?
I don't know. Maybe I don't bring attention to it. Assuring people like, look, if you listen, you're going to get it. Just give it time.
That's a good promo. Just listen to it.
Give it time.
You'll figure it out.
Is this the promo right now?
Isn't it?
Okay, I think we got it.
Cinephobe.
Wherever you get podcasts.
Adam. I have something to tell you.
What's that?
I'm so jacked up on coffee. All I've done is drink coffee all day. I haven't even had anything to eat. I'm ready for the show.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
You going to wish
Coming
me luck?
Coming to you live from
no,
our
that's
houses
my line.
In Los Angeles.
Here we go.
All right. Scorpions on you.
Coming to you live from our houses in Los Angeles, California, it's Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, your comedy field guide to life. Tonight, there's no sense in beating a dead horse, but there's every reason to beat a dead parrot, and that's precisely what Paula will learn to do tonight when she takes an acting lesson from the one and only John Cleese. Yes, you heard me right. John Cleese will be joining us for Outside the Actor's Studio. Plus... oh, who cares about what else? We've got John Cleese. You know you're going to want to hear that. Also on this show, it's John Cleese, right after that segment with John Cleese. In conclusion, John Cleese. I'm Adam Felber, this show's Minister of Humor, making sure that all levity is applied properly and in pre-approved locations, fully permitted and signed in triplicate in compliance with the Comedic Audio Distribution Act of 1978. And now, please welcome the woman who fully expects the Spanish Inquisition, but nonetheless always looks on the bright side of life. It's Paula Poundstone.
Yay.
Hello again, Paula.
So lovely to be here again. All right, I have to apologize to my co-workers explain to the audience... this is our second recording of the first third of this show because we all record from our own devices and my recording didn't work for whatever reason the first time. So we found out like a day or two later when they went to put the show together with the tapes and the huda and the hada, they said, oh, Paul, yours didn't record, which is really surprising among the group of us because my technical skills are legendary.
Yeah.
Legendary. I remember Han Solo used to sometimes call me from the spaceship and say, you know, which button do we push? Because I am that good.
And so this is a weird fluke. But as you said, it is like 3 days later. And I just want to say to everybody, if you're listening to this show right now and then you get to the second segment and you're like, wow, they sound so much younger and less wise than they did in the first segment. Well, now you know why.
Yeah. Time travel. Yep. That's why. Which, by the way, have I not long suspected that there's some form of time travel going on that's causing all these bad things to happen?
Yeah, you have.
I do.
Yeah, you do.
So, Adam.
Yeah.
Let's thank the house band.
Yes.
Could you?
Oh, yes. Let's thank tonight's house band. Returning champion, Lindsay Goodman from Pickerington, Ohio, on the flute. Welcome, Lindsay. Oh, we love you. Great to have you here.
Yeah.
All right. So I was, you know, I work very hard, Adam. Okay. So before I go on a live concert performance, which sounds highfalutin, but before I do that, I usually do interviews with the radio and, you know, newspapers or local publications to where I'm going to say, like, hey, I'm going to be here. So I have on a couple of occasions done an interview wherein I have said that I am jealous of musicians in general. But that especially because one of the questions that a lot of interviewers like to ask now is, how did you get through the, you know, the stay-at-home order? So I explained to them that when that first happened, everybody that was putting together, you know, charity galas or whatever kind of shows, they all had to move to some kind of, you know, it's virtual, it's like they're there kind of shows. And so I got asked to do tons of those. And I discovered very early on that one cannot do stand-up comedy from their living room. And I have the shrapnel from the bombing to prove it. you just can't. You have to have a response. And what they would always say to me when I would say, like, geez, that doesn't sound like a good idea. They would say, oh, no, we'll laugh. We'll laugh. It'll be great. It'll be great. Well, what they were swept up with was musicians, the motherfuckers, musicians, when they were doing their Zoom performances for shows, it came off so wonderfully. It's like, oh, it was so intimate. And Mary Chapin Carpenter, they did a piece on the NewsHour. They aired it more than once. You know, Mary Chapin Carpenter, an intimate concert she was giving from her living room, and they oohed and awed over it. Isn't that? Oh, it's so, you feel like you're right there with her. She's in her living room. Oh, her dog came in. And Mary Chapin Carpenter with the guitar and the ooh. And so I had said in interviews that I fucking hate Mary Chapin Carpenter because I feel very jealous. And that she's ruined it for everyone. So I'm working in Virginia a couple days ago, whenever, I don't even know anymore. At some point before we second time taped this show. So I was working in Virginia and I come into the dressing room backstage and there's some flowers there. And, you know, sometimes the venue gives me flowers and I had a little envelope under it, say Paula Poundstone. But I didn't open it right away. They were pretty flowers, by the way. It was a lovely arrangement. But I didn't open it right away because I just thought, oh, it's from the venue. It's just going to, you know, thanks for being here, that kind of thing. So after a while, I did open it. And it has a printout of an article that I did that's folded up inside this card. And then on the card is handwritten, Dear Paula, I love you anyway, or we love you anyway, or something like that. And I realized when I looked more closely at it, it's from Mary Chapin Carpenter. And she sent me a copy of the interview or a printout of an interview proving to me that she knows I had said this.
That's amazing.
So I go, I grab my flat thing because Tony wasn't with me. So I quickly Googled, where does Mary Chapin Carpenter live? Because I'm like, this is a joke. This is not from her. And she lives in Virginia.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, it might have been from her. And then I go out on stage and I tell the audience the story. And finally, at the end of the show, when I'm closing, I said, you know, it might have been a joke. It might not really have been. And some lady in the crowd goes, no, it wasn't. And it wasn't Mary Chapin. It was somebody that Mary Chapin Carpenter had called and asked to deliver the flowers. So the whole point of this long story is that fucking bitch, Mary Chapin Carpenter, practically ruined my night.
But the moral of the story is, if you want famous people to like you, tell them to go fuck themselves.
That's the best way. No, that's not true, because you know what? Because we as a nation moved to that phase a couple years ago. So I would say that's not true.
Okay.
People are already telling people to go fuck themselves. And I, on the other hand, am just kidding. It was very sweet.
It was very sweet.
Mary Chapin Carpenter. Well, you know, who hates a singer, songwriter, folksy person?
Mary Chapin Carpenter. Nobody.
Just me. Just me. Well, Adam, well, yes. I did listen to, you know, because I've been listening to Eat, Pray, Fark. So I think we should open up the book club.
All right, let's bring this to order, the second coming of this week's book club.
Yay!
Oh, wait, I have the theme song.
Oh, thank goodness.
Excellent. Yeah.
Okay, here we go. I did something a little different this week to entertain you guys. My book club done told me our book is a stinker. La, 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 la. I wish Gilbert was deeper. Lose your ego, lose your ego, lose your ego.
Wow.
Wow. That, okay.
You know, I like the way that you brought us back to the memorable, the immortal, lose your leg, lose your leg, lose your leg from Moby Dick.
Yes, I agree. Although I would question one thing, Bonnie, which is it's a four-line theme song that you wrote, and you chose to, you kind of ran out of steam on that third line, it sounds right, like, and instead just sang la, 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 la.
Right, because I couldn't, right, because I couldn't think of anything to say in there that worked. Do you guys have an idea?
I think la, la is time honored. What's the song that they go, la, 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 la?
Yeah, but that's intentional. It wasn't because they, that thing, sing a song, the Muppets.
This was totally intentional.
She just said that it wasn't.
It is. She doesn't. She doesn't know. She can't even hear the theme song when she sings it. She's not even sure what she's singing.
I hear most of the time. You mumble.
No, you don't hear most of the time.
She doesn't
you
mumble.
You have that flip phone, no. And it's got that thing, and you're walking the no. dog, and you no. go like, no.
Bonnie,
that's not my fault.
You told a story about you not hearing and then just immediately flipped it over to an opportunity to chew out Paula, her phone, and her manner of speaking.
Yeah. She doesn't know that she did that because she didn't hear what she just said.
Okay. You know, so and we're in the book club.
She tried to make an appointment with an audiologist, but they didn't pick up. When she called, she just kept saying, hello, hello, hello.
All right. I'm gonna insist. I know how hard this is, guys. I know.
Okay. Are we gonna do the book club? Great.
I know it's awful because as hard as it is to read this book, imagine our position where we're having to do these fucking chapters twice.
It's no problem for me. When I was listening to these chapters, and we are doing chapters 56 through 65, but when I was listening in my hotel room, because I've been listening to the audio version of it that Elizabeth Gilbert herself reads, I finished listening to those chapters, and then I listened again. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, how lonely do I have to be to listen twice to Elizabeth Gilbert read chapters 56 to 65. So, Adam, would you give us the summary of what happens in those chapters?
Yeah, this is a particularly painful moment for us because these were supposed to be the chapters where Elizabeth Gilbert stops the navel-gazing, leaves the ashram and goes and explores the rest of India and goes to meet the Dalai Lama and goes to all the big sites in India. So we were looking forward to that.
But she was kidnapped, right?
No, well, no such luck.
Oh, okay. But she was on an airplane and she had to, the pilot had a heart attack and she had to steer the... No?
If only. Oh. Instead, she decides, you know what? Forget about traveling to the rest of the India.
But wait, there was a raging fire, and she family out, and the kid was on crutch.
Nope. She decided to stay at the ashram and continue to gaze into her own navel, except to drive the one interesting character from this section to the airport. So we lose him. And she ends up driving back from the airport, deciding she was going to be, you know, quieter and less chatty, and then finds out that she's been basically appointed cruise director of the ashram for a while, so she's really happy about that. Then she gets to talk, and she realizes, as she does in almost every chapter, that the person that she was all along is really great, and everybody loves that person.
Oh, Wow. So it's not really full of excitement and adventure the way I was thinking.
Yeah, no.
No, I'm confusing it with something else.
Yeah.
Yeah, she does pretty much the conclusion every time she feels she has a breakthrough is that someone, and it's often her own voice or her own handwriting, someone that she then decides is God tells her she's fantastic.
Yes, and the only other spiritual experience she has in these chapters is I guess she invites the blue light spiritual version of her ex-husband into the ashram so they can discuss the terms of their breakup, and then they come to a peaceful resolution of some sort.
You know, she should write down what happens between those two blue light, you know, one of the blue lights was her and one was her husband. She should write down what happens because maybe she gets a better settlement out of it. So she should write down and bring that into court.
Yeah.
You know, do you remember the Twilight Zone episode with Talking Tina the doll?
Absolutely.
You know, my name is Talking Tina and I don't like you. I'm telling you, Elizabeth Gilbert could pull Talking Tina's string and Talking Tina would say, my name is Talking Tina and you're perfect, Elizabeth. God loves you.
I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
My name is Talking Tina, and your ex-husband told me to tell you. You owe him more money, Elizabeth.
Hey, everybody. As longtime listeners know, when Helix Mattresses first started sponsoring our show, Bonnie Burns somehow got the drop on me and made off with the first mattress. But in the intervening years, I have gotten myself a Helix mattress. I've had it for almost a year now, and it has improved my sleep. It has improved my life. I could not be happier. The Helix lineup offers 20 unique mattresses, including the award-winning Lux Collection, which I have, the newly released Helix Elite Collection, which is a mattress designed just for big and tall sleepers, and they even have mattresses made just for kids. Now, if you're like me and you were a little nervous about trying it online, or like Paula, who was screaming in fear of buying a mattress online, don't be. The Helix Sleep Quiz takes into account your individual sleep preference to match you and your partner with the perfect mattress. I took the quiz and I ended up with the great mattress for a side sleeper, the Helix Midnight Lux. Take my word for it, everybody. The Helix Midnight Lux.
Oh, don't want to take Adam's word for it. I don't blame you. Helix has been awarded the number one mattress picked by GQ and Wired magazine. It's even recommended by multiple leading chiropractors and doctors of sleep medicine as a go-to solution for improving your sleep. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners.
Go to helixsleep.com/Paula. That's helixsleep.com/Paula and use the code HELIXPARTNER20.
This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
Paula, I invited you over, but you fell asleep. HelixSleep.com/Paula. And if you're going to do it anyway,
use our code.
The detective came and knocked on the door. And I said, is it Renee? And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to season 2 of Proof, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's open up this discussion. Second time around, from the Simi Valley, from way downtown, it's Bonnie Burns. Captain Crinkle, what do you got?
Well, actually, I don't think Simi Valley has a downtown.
No, it's a basketball expression, like you're taking a shot from far away.
Oh, thanks for telling me.
Sure.
I appreciate learning new things, of which I haven't learned really anything new in this book. You know, I think my biggest problem with it is I find her self-discovery not interesting, and that she thinks it's an accomplishment, for example, that I guess she was supposed to sit still and quiet for 2 hours, and that she managed to get through that without slapping the mosquitoes on her body was a real accomplishment.
Yeah.
That's just so, it's like, I feel like every chapter I read, I'm just about to get to the finish line. And then it's like, oh, this is it. It's so nothing. And then this guy, Richard, she has such a hard time wrapping her mind around when he says, like, okay, she's a control freak. And he says to her, if you want to control things, you have to control the thoughts in your mind. She has a hard time understanding that concept. I just am so interested in finding out about her journey. That's my problem.
You know, I'm surprised because I've known Bonnie for a long, long time, and she tends to like the idea of self-discovery.
Right, but this isn't self-discovery by anybody. What she's finding out, her accomplishments are like, I took the garbage out. I'm so great. I didn't have to do that before. Look at me. I scrubbed the floor.
Wow.
Her interpretations are boring.
I'm really surprised that you're not getting a lot out of this book.
Well, we're only at Eat and Pray. Don't forget, we have Love coming up, and it might be better. Oh, by the way, on the subject of love, I just want to point out one passage that was interesting to me, is that when she was talking to her blue light husband, she was reflecting back at when they were not just blue lights. And she says, you know, we were two limited people who had argued for years about sex and money and furniture. Look, I'm no relationship guru, but if you're literally arguing about sex for years, that relationship should have ended years ago.
Unless one person just recently viewed like some sort of a porn channel.
Right.
Some sort of a how-to guidance.
Right.
And, you know, and it somehow changed their approach.
Right, sure.
Then I would say maybe some of these things didn't come up years ago. But, she says, yeah, she's been arguing for, okay,
she's
maybe.
She's arguing for, yeah, my point is, yes, if you see something on a porn channel and you go to your partner and you say, you know what, I'd like to try this. And your partner says, well, I don't want to. That's kind of the end of the argument, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm really speaking in an arena that I have no business in.
Well, then. Trust me, folks, if you're having an argument about sex, it's over.
Well, okay, I get what you mean there. But I think if the things that you argued about include furniture, that seems to me like when you look at the list about, you know, the top things that couples argue about that dissolve the marriage, furniture is not on that list. I mean, how vacuous do you have to be?
He was the perfect man, but his taste in chairs was terrible and we had to end it.
I could see that.
They couldn't come to a compromise there?
I guess not.
No, I could see that. That's part of the reason I'm single is I don't own a couch and I have Adirondack chairs in my living room. And
that might be part of it. I think another part might be you have no interest in having a relationship.
Well, that's the other thing. It's not exactly the Playboy pouch.
Hey, I know that laugh. That's Tony Anita Hall in Sherman Oaks.
It's me.
What you got for us, Tony?
So I actually got a little weepy during these chapters, and I don't know if it's because I was just tired or I was reading it while I was watching the Tony Awards, but I just found
myself... Wait a minute. You couldn't watch the Tony Awards and read at the same time.
Yes, you can.
No, you can't.
I used to do my homework in front of the TV.
I think that since you already read the book a couple times, that perhaps you could just run your eyes over the words and it reminds you. But you're not thinking about the Tony Awards and the book at the same time. The brain just doesn't work that way. Haven't we had a brain scientist on before that explained that?
I believe.
Yeah. Well, Bonnie didn't hear him and Tony wasn't listening because she was Googling.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah. She says she was watching. She wasn't watching the Tony Awards. She was Googling the Tony Awards.
I did do some Tony as well.
Tony Anita Hall. Is that why you were watching the Tony Awards? Because they're awards that you bestow on people? Oh, my gosh. I hope I get a Tony tonight. I do.
All right, Tony, let me just ask you. So what were your impressions of those chapters other than, gee, that Neil Patrick Harris is talented?
Okay.
Oh, shouldn't like that.
I honestly don't know who hosted the Tonys this year, but that was my first reach.
It was Audra McDonald.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, then Tony
Leslie Odom Jr. hosted the second part.
Did she do it from an ashram?
No, she didn't do it from an ashram.
I just wondered if you confused the two stories. In the beginning, was she driving the Texas guy to the airport? Is that ringing a bell?
I'm not justifying these questions with answers.
That'd be dignifying. Whoa. But go ahead.
Dignifying, excuse me.
That's all right.
No, it just seems that she's finding peace, and I think that's really beautiful. And if I ever write a memoir, I don't want any of you to read it. That's for sure.
Oh, oh Tony, oh. We like you, and your life is interesting.
Tony, yeah,
I agree. You've got perspective. That's what's wrong. She doesn't have perspective.
I so hope that you do write a memoir, Tony Anita Hall. You have so much to talk about and such a perspective, as you mentioned, that could enlighten so many people. Like you could explain to people how you lived your life reading a book and watching television at the same time.
Hey, look, everybody. It's Mrs. Culpepper, our favorite Southern Belle hand puppet and huge fan of Tony Anita Hall.
Tony Anita Hall. If you were to write a memoir, I would read it more than once. In fact, I would buy individual copies for each time I read it.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Culpepper. I appreciate you.
Why, you're welcome. I don't know why that Paula Poundstone would tell you that you can't read. Watch the Tonys at the same time. Of course, Tony Anita Hall can do anything. She can do no wrong.
You're right. That's a vile calumny from Paula Poundstone, right, Mrs. Culpepper?
It is a vile calumny. We're so happy to have Tony Anita Hall. We have to do whatever we can to keep her with us instead of off on some life-threatening cruise.
Well, there's nothing that dangerous about cruises, are there? I mean, generally, you just go on the ocean and you play around and they have great little, like, you know, wine and cheese nights and stuff.
Oh, you have to be very careful with cheese. That's just one of the dangers of a cruise.
What's so dangerous about cheese, Mrs. Culpepper?
Well, one might experience a thing called triotoxism, which is what killed Captain Culpepper.
What? Oh, that's right. My apologies, Mrs. Culpepper. Once again, that slipped my mind.
I don't know why you can't keep that thought in your head. It's because you're watching the Tonys while I tell you. That's what the problem is.
Wow, that Neil Patrick Harris is great. Wait, what'd you say?
Exactly.
Well, I am sorry about your husband, your late husband, and his run-in with triotoxism and that bad sour cream that he ate.
It was not a sour cream. It's a poisoning from a cheese or dairy product, but it was not sour cream. It was a cheese He was eating a cheese, and that was his last act.
Oh, the poor man. It was the cheddar that got him.
It was the Gouda that got him, not the cheddar at all.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Culpepper. And with that, unless Mrs. Culpepper has any thoughts about Elizabeth Gilbert and these chapters.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt, Tony Anita Hull. Tony Anita Hull, did you have it? So you found yourself tearing up over the book?
Yeah, tearing up a little bit. I don't disagree, though, that I think she may lack some perspective on things. I do agree with Bonnie Burns on that.
But it really does almost feel like a story told by a kid at some point, right? Because she keeps getting herself into trouble and then completely resolving the situation. Then she's at peace with herself. And then the same thing happens again every couple of pages.
It's based on Leave It to Beaver.
That's camp. There should be a theme song that sounds like a sitcom theme song, Bonnie.
Okay. Let's see. But then,
oh, not now.
Okay, let me see.
Yeah, give it some thought.
I'll work on it.
Yeah, after you finish filling in the la-la-las from your last theme song. All right, so you know what? I've had enough of this. I've done it twice now. With that, I am bringing book club to a close. Paula, do you have a word for us?
I do, Adam. Adam, the word is flagitious. It's an adjective that means criminal, villainous. Here, I'll use it in a sentence. The list of flagitious Republican office holders seems to grow overnight. Let me use it in a family setting. Perhaps that's more helpful. Mom, can I go to Scott's after dinner? Do you think that's such a good idea on a school night? It's Friday, Mom. Oh, of course it is. I picked you up after soccer practice. No, Scott's mom picked us up. God damn it. Is this cauliflower in the mashed potatoes? Jeez, Dad, you scared the heck out of me. I asked Mom to try making the potatoes with cauliflower. I thought they'd be good that way. I'm not flagitious. You're not what? We'll not talk about flagellation at our dinner table. Dad, flagitious is an adjective that means criminal, villainous. You're confusing it with flagellation, which is whipping someone either as a form of religious punishment or for sexual pleasure. You did it. You did it again. Now go upstairs and don't do anything while you're up there. Flagitious is a great word. I'm going to put it right into the vocabulary song. Boy, in the first taping, I could not get that song right. This week's word is flagitious. It's an adjective that means criminal, villainous. That man licked all the candy. Fuck me. This week's word is flagitious. It's an adjective that means criminal, villainous. That man licked all the candy that was given us. Last week's word was ninny hammer. It's a noun that means a fool or simpleton. It was my idea to use squeaky balls. Oh, fuck. It was my idea to use squeaky tennis balls at Wimbledon. Uh-oh. Son of a bitch. I don't have the other page.
You don't?
No, fuck.
Well, you know what, Paula, I have it. Do you want me to sing the rest of it?
Yes, please.
All right. I love that I'm doing this. The week before that, the word was horripilation. It's a noun that means the erection of hair on the skin due to cold, fear, or excitement. Got hair so thick I couldn't squeeze through a tight vent. Going back before that, the word was ineffable. It's an adjective that means too great or extreme to be expressed in words. Elected officials supporting the big lie are really turds. And not long before that, the word was nadir, which Adam pronounces nadir. It's a noun that means the lowest point in the fortunes of a person or organization. I'm trapped in an elevator with an evangelical Christian and a nauseated Dalmatian. Let's never forget Gallimaufry. Gallimaufry, which I pronounced wrong until nobody, James Heider, corrected me. It's a noun that means confused jumble or medley of things. Hodgepodge, who's podge, hodgepodge. Adam doesn't think my song is replicable. Replicable, replicable. Take it, Paula.
But I do, I do, I do, I do. Adam, that was fantastic.
Wait, play me out, play me out. Yay.
Wow. That was extraordinary.
Was it?
Oh, it was. I'm sure there's a vocabulary word that could better describe it, but I can't remember.
Well, it was an honor to sing a song which, if I was able to sing it, I have been proven completely wrong because it was replicable.
Replicable.
All right. Coming up, I quote, acting is an expression of a neurotic impulse. It's a bum's life. Quitting acting, that's the sign of maturity. That was Marlon Brando, who died while working on a new film at the age of 80. We'll explore our immaturity with John Cleese next on Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone.
Jesus fucks.
Get ready for the miracle of Mega, a comedy podcast from the staff of a fictional mega church.
And not only does he fuck, but he's the best at it.
I'm Holly Loren.
And I'm Greg Hess.
Our characters, Hallie and Gray, welcome a new guest each week, played by some of the biggest names in comedy and podcasting.
Like Scott Aukerman, Lauren Lapkus, Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas, Cecily Strong, and Duncan Trussell.
I just love to think about that, the light shining down on all those corpses in the water and Noah just going by and maybe a mom being like, please, we're running out of energy. Can you please let us on the boat?
It's completely improvised and it's devilishly funny.
Is there any question you have for us about, you know, what it means to live a life in Christ?
I guess, how much do you think is bullshit?
There's a new episode every Sunday.
Listen and subscribe to Mega, wherever you get your podcasts.
Best I ever had. Best I, y'all can do it, y'all can do it. Y'all sing along. You know what I'm saying? Here go. Jesus, you the best.
Jesus, you're the best.
You to be the best.
Jesus, you're the best.
You the okay,
best
never mind.
Best I ever had. Best wow. I ever had.
The spread of misinformation has fueled our cultural divide and increased our collective anxiety about the future. Tackling misinformation isn't a simple task, but it's important. And that's why I'm so excited to tell you about Conspirituality, a podcast that's dismantling New Age cults, wellness grifters, and conspiracy mad yogis.
On the show, a journalist, a cult researcher, and a philosophical skeptic walk into a bar, and the bartender says, no, it's not that old joke. They dive deep into current events, such as RFK Jr.'s involvement in mainstreaming dangerous anti-vax rhetoric. They crowdsource, research, analyze, and dream up answers to the problem with, get this, proven science as their ultimate guiding light.
I highly recommend you check out Conspirituality's fascinating episodes on creating comedy in the MAGAverse with Jordan Klepper or RFK Jr. flirting with body fascism.
And you've listened to a bunch of them at this point, Paul, I know, and you tell me you love it.
I do. They're fascinating, and my favorite part is they use, wait for it, proven science.
And
if there's any kids listening, that's a class we used to take. Proven yep. science as their ultimate guiding light. I love that.
From exploring cults to analyzing our cultural and political landscape, the Conspirituality podcast will help you stay informed about misinformation and help you resist fear tactics. Find Conspirituality on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this day in unremarkable history, Chopin said, "Stop calling me Chopin."
And we're back. Thank you, house band Lindsay Goodman. So, Paula Poundstone, here in Hollywood, the gears of show business are grinding back to life, which means you're back to auditioning again, right?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
I have a question for you. How are those acting chops?
To be totally honest, just as bad as they always were.
Really? Because we've had some really, really distinguished actors here on the show for Outside the Actors Studio coach you on your acting methods.
Well, okay, you know what? I take that back. I haven't had that kind of audition yet. So I haven't been able to bring to bear that which I have learned from Outside the Actors Studio.
Then what we're going to do is just add to your acting arsenal right now, if that's okay.
Oh, I'm excited.
Oh, yeah, we have somebody who might be able to help. John Cleese won a BAFTA award for his performance as Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers, therefore a qualified actor. He also starred in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You might have heard of it, Life of Brian and the Meaning of Life, with a group called Monty Python. He was also nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay for A Fish Called Wanda. Not an acting honor, but I thought I'd want to mention it. Now he's back on the road in his show Why There Is No Hope, where he examines the dysfunctional planet we're all stuck upon. Please welcome legendary comedic actor John Cleese.
Yay! Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Ben.
We are so excited to have you. You know what?
Yes.
When Adam said Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Life of Brian and the Meaning of Life, I spontaneously smiled. And we're not even using the video part of Zoom. It makes me smile just to hear the titles.
They were very good films, or at least Life of Brian was very good. And actually, right now, Paula, I'm turning it into a stage show.
Oh, are you?
Yes, and if you think that the original film caused a bit of an uproar, you wait till the stage show comes out. My plan is to make it so incendiary that evangelicals burn the theater down on the opening night because then it'll run for my life.
It's so good. You know what? I watched it, I think it was over the summer, I watched it again for the first time in years, and there honestly is not a second where there are no unfunny lines in the whole thing. And usually when you watch a film that you enjoyed years ago, sometimes, you know, parts of it don't hold up that well. I'm telling you, this thing was still laugh out loud funny the whole way through. I mean, blessed are the cheesemakers. It just doesn't get any better than that.
No, it's lovely, isn't it? But blessed are the Greek. Did anyone get the name? Most remarkable thing of all was the revolutionary who didn't want to be a man anymore, who wanted to be a woman, and
who
wanted to have the right to have babies, although he couldn't actually have babies, of course. That was written in 1978, and people are arguing about it now.
And where was the fetus going to gestate? In a fucking shoebox?
Right.
Let me just say on that subject, just the universal appeal of that movie. My son last week auditioned for a show. He's a 13-year-old, and his audition song was Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Yeah, it's a very good song, isn't it?
It is.
It's a beautiful song.
Well, the funny thing is, I tend to be known by younger people now either as Nearly Headless Nick.
Oh, right.
Or in the Bond films, but in both of which I appeared, if you blinked, you'd have missed me. But the kids now don't know the earlier Python stuff. But I'm very famous as Nearly Headless Nick. I was in two movies, and altogether my screen time was 36 seconds.
You made it memorable.
Yeah, that's right. All right. I hate to ask you such a pedestrian question, but I don't know the answer, which is how did you get started?
Oh, I was at Cambridge, and there was a nice group of people there who used to have a little club room, and they used to do little shows once a month, and it was all very amateurish, and we were all going to become doctors and that sort of thing. And then in the last year, we put a show on at the local professional theatre. And for some extraordinary reason, it happened to be very good. There were three or four good people in it, and we got moved to the West End. Wow. And I just got a law degree, and thank God I escaped from the legal profession and worked at the BBC as a producer-writer because I had no pretension to be a performer at all. And then the review was revivified. And we went around New Zealand, and then we went to Broadway and lasted 3 weeks. And I wondered what to do. And David Frost, the famous David Frost, rang me up and said, would you like to be in a TV show? And the next thing, I was in a PKR program in 1966, and that started me off. And I've been trying to escape and do something more worthwhile and sensible, but I always get hauled back, and I'm a sec. I quite enjoy it because, as you know, Paula, when you make people laugh, everybody feels good.
It is. Yes. And when I watched Life of Brian and I also watched Meaning of Life on the same day, it was in the midst of the stay-at-home order.
Yeah.
Out of work, right? Just depressed as all get out. And I sat down, and I am not a person to sit in a chair and do nothing very much. I very rarely sit down and watch a movie, but I just gave myself that day. And I tell you, it was one of the most memorable days of the stay-at-home order for me. And it was the perfect medicine.
Isn't that lovely? Because the odd thing about comedy, I always used to think that comedians like us were kind of a luxury. And I've come to the conclusion we're more important than that now. If I meet people after the show, the stage show that I do, that I'm doing in California, a couple of upcoming, which Adam mentioned, if I do that and meet people afterwards, there are 70-year-old men who shake me by the hand and they say, thank you for making me laugh for 40 years. And there's a tear in their eye.
It is a nice thing.
The women say something different, which is funny. They say, thank you for helping me to form my sense of humor, which is a huge compliment. You see what I mean? Because it's much more than just making people laugh. And it's taken me about, well, I'm just about to turn 82. It's taken me about 72 years to realize that comedy is more important than I thought.
Oh, it is very important. All right, I have something terrible to confess. I never saw the television show Monty Python Flying Circus.
It only ever went out on PBS. It was much too risky to go out anywhere else.
Well, here's how I knew about it. You know, it was on the educational channel. And frankly, I've always been kind of a moron, and I was a little put off by the educational channel. But in high school, Neil Maurer, who was just a guy in my high school, a lovely guy, but he would come to school, I guess, the day after the show, you know, would air, and he would do impressions of it. And so I knew of you guys only through the interpretation of Neil Maurer for like a couple of years until the movies came out.
Whatever happened to Neil?
He now lives in Burlington, Vermont, and he directs musical theater stuff for the public schools there.
And John, he's very grateful for making him laugh for these last 50 years, but still too proud to admit that you helped form his sense of humor.
Yeah. But, you know, I've talked to people from the Midwest, and, you know, there wasn't anything like Monty Python around. And some of them had just sort of lit something inside, deep inside their soul that they didn't know they had until Monty Python lit it. And that's lovely.
I often refer to the part of Life of Brian where Brian's running away from the Roman soldiers and he gets into the spaceship that just appears from out of nowhere and it takes him around the whole earth and then lands him right back where he was before and he's still being pursued by the Roman soldiers. That metaphor is so appropriate for so many things that occur in life. So you guys were not only funny, you were deep, very deep.
But Paula, tell me what bell that rang with you, him being dumped back in exactly the place he started from.
Oh, I feel like that all the time. I never feel like I get a leg up on anything. I just, you know, I get every time I wake up, I'm like, I'm just getting off that spaceship. Now, and again, forgive the pedestrian nature of the question, but how did you guys work? These scenes in these movies, were they all written down? Did you improvise at all? Did you improvise during the making of the screenplay?
No, we were all, if you want to understand this, and people find this odd, but I promise you it's true, we were six writers. Well, five writers and an animator. And what we did was we just went off. I went off with Graham Chapman and Michael and Terry usually worked together, Eric on his own, and we just wrote. And when we first went into the BBC and they said, we understand you guys want to do a television series, a comedy series. And we said, well, we'd love to. And the guy said to us, so what do you propose doing? And we couldn't tell him because we hadn't discussed it. That is absolutely amazing. And he asked us a few questions, which we were unable to answer because we hadn't discussed them. And then he looked at us and shrugged and said, go away and make 13 programs.
But in
wow.
I know. It's never happened before. It'll never happen again.
No, but it won't.
It was an advantage from the point of view of creativity because it meant we started without any what's the word, any preconditions, any feeling that this was the sort of thing that we should be doing. In fact, we did sit down and talk to each other three or four times to try and figure out what we were going to do. And we couldn't agree on anything because we never could agree on anything. And then Terry Jones said, oh, let's go home and write. And then we all went home and wrote some stuff and none of us knew if it was funny or not. And then we all got together and read it out and we found that we were laughing at each other's material. But the whole thing was wonderfully unstructured. And I think that's why it was able to be so original.
Is this the first? Are we getting an exclusive here? Is this the first time that you've confessed that no one could work with Eric Idle?
Oh, no, none of us could work with any of the others.
Eric had to work alone. I heard that. I heard the underpinnings of that.
Eric's great. Everyone, you see, the essence of a good group, Paula, is that people are good at different things. And people don't realize that that's what you want in a group of people. You want people with different expertises. And for example, Gilliam was an extraordinary animator. Jones had very, very good big ideas for sketches, but he wasn't terribly good at dialogue. Eric wasn't so strong writing sketches or scenes for the film, but he's phenomenal at his lyrics and a lot of the songs he writes the tunes. He's so strong at everything to do with music. And there wasn't any music in the first two series of Monty Python. And Michael Palin, well, he just isn't terribly good. he stay in the group because he was jolly nice and he would make his coffee and all that kind of thing. So he was allowed to stay. And then Terry Jones was Welsh and megalomaniac and wanted to be in charge of everything and tell everyone else exactly what to do. So he and I did a lot of non-physical fighting, but it added a little spice to the meetings.
That's wonderful.
All right, so tell me about, say, In the Meaning of Life, for example, which was a series of sketches. It wasn't just one overarching story.
Skits.
Is there one that you wrote, or is there one that was your favorite?
The Sex Lecture, Graham Chapman and I wrote.
Oh, my gosh.
I love that.
I learned so much from it.
And then right at the beginning, because Graham was actually a qualified doctor, the thing about the birth being treated like an operation, if you see what I mean, that I thought was very funny. But Terry D. Jones wrote my favorite bit, which was, of course, the very fat man who goes into the restaurant. And
Mr. Creosote.
Yes.
I think that's absolutely wonderful. It's a masterpiece of bad taste.
It's so great. My kids are still upset with me. I showed it to them, like maybe they were a little too young. And they were just repulsed.
I love the simplicity of that scene. It's going in a horrible direction from the very beginning. And what makes it wonderful is that it never deviates. It just gets there.
Inevitably, yeah.
How long did it take him? I mean, because the makeup to make him into this huge man was amazing.
It was, and the extraordinary thing about Jonesy was his energy. You see, I'm not particularly energetic, and I'm lazy anyway. But that scene was not only written by Terry Jones and directed by him, but he also performed in it. And he had to put that fat suit on, and hours he was dedicated. I'd had that dedication, I would have been quite good.
Oh, I think you managed. I got one more question. Have you had any audition or performance disasters?
Yes. When I was in New York in 1965, and our show, the review that we toured with, had come off, and we'd gone to a little club on Washington Square, and we'd finished our run there, and I was wondering what to do. And my agent rang me up and said, do you want to audition for a Broadway musical? And I thought this was the funniest thing ever because I'm so unmusical, you could not believe it. So I said, yes. So I went along, and they gave me some pages. And, you know, I was playing an upper-class twit, so I made them laugh. And then they said, could you sing something? And I said, no. He said, no, can you just sing something? I said, I can't remember a tune. I'm hopeless. I really can't remember. And they said, well, could you sing your national anthem? And I said, all right, how does it go? And then I did sing the national anthem appallingly. And I went home thinking, hey, you know, this is terrific. I might actually be able to tell my grandchildren that I auditioned for a Broadway musical. And the phone rang and the agent said, you got the part.
Really?
What?
I couldn't believe it. Well, I wasn't in any solo numbers. I was only in the chorus numbers, but I went to rehearsal the first day and I raced over. I arrived early and I raced over and I said to the musical director, Stanley Lubowski, I said, Stanley, I told them at auditions I cannot sing.
What'd he say?
And what'd he say?
And then he took me over to the piano and hit a few notes. And then he said, all right, you can't sing. Then he said, learn the lines and mime. And for 6 months, I was in a hit musical. And I never sang a note. I was just...
Oh, that's so great.
Isn't that extraordinary?
It really is.
So that's how terrible I am at music.
Now they could auto-tune you or something. You know, now they can put like a mic on you and then they can do stuff at a board that would make you, that you could actually star in the musical now.
Yeah. I think the question there is, what's the fucking point? I don't get someone who can sing in the first place.
You might want to, before you retire, do Oklahoma.
Why did you mention Oklahoma when my third wife, who cost me $20 million, came from Oklahoma? I think that's spiteful for you to have dug that up.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes up?
And where the sky is as high as an elephant's thigh, or some terrible lyric.
Those are really bad lyrics.
Yeah.
Well, you know, guys, if I may, the actress Alicia Witt once said, quote, acting is magical. Change your look and your attitude, and you can be anyone. At least I think it was Alicia Witt. I mean, if she's right, it could have been anybody. We'll get some acting tips from someone who has the look and attitude of John Cleese when we come back. The cat of the week is El Gato Negro del Diablo from Groveland, New York.
Oh, you can't tell me anything about cats. My wife and I have four cats. Three of them are American, Maine Coons. And they are the biggest fucking cats you've ever seen. One of them weighs 31 pounds.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
That's a lot of cat.
Wow.
I almost got a Maine Coon and then I lost my job and I thought I wouldn't be, you know, I thought it doesn't make sense to bring another cat into the house. And so I didn't.
Another cat into the world.
Yeah, I have 10 cats.
Come on. Have you really?
Yeah. I used to have 16.
When I had a ranch, Paula Poundstone, I once had 23.
Oh.
Before my divorce.
Wow. Was that the Oklahoma woman?
Yes, the Oklahoma woman. That's right.
And does that 23 count her?
No. We gave them to all of our friends, you know. But the ones that we have in London are huge. And one of them, called Felix, is so huge that we've had a small saddle made for him so that my wife can ride him around the apartment.
That's nice. That's nice. That's good.
It is nice. As far as I'm concerned, animals are the main purpose to be alive. I think they give us absolute insane amounts of pleasure. And I just think we should give them votes.
And we're back with John Cleese. This is such a pleasure. But, John, we didn't bring you here just to chat. As I think we mentioned, Paula needs yet another masterclass in acting, and you're here to do just that, if you are willing.
Oh, yes, I'm willing.
All right. Well, we're extremely lucky to have you then. And let's now go outside the actor's studio. All right. Well, Paula Poundstone, you have prepared a scene for yourself and Mr. Cleese. Am I correct?
Yes.
John, are you ready to both perform and sort of give her director and redirector after we do the scene?
After the scene, I will assess her talent and give her advice.
Great. All right. Are we ready, everybody? Let's quiet down. Let's change the lighting a little bit. Ah, that's good. Here we go.
A little bit brighter so I can read the script.
I'm going to bring it up on you a little bit. Let's bring Paula's special down. She's a little hot. Powder for Paula, please. And here we go. Dunstan Steele is a sought-after director. He knows exactly how long every scene will take to shoot, not because he's prescient, but because he has been doing this a long time. He was one of the foremost practitioners of shooting actors reflected in other actors' aviator glasses. Pamela Murray has finally landed an acting job. She's old enough to have developed more confidence, but she hasn't. On a television soundstage, a bright white roll-out background is surrounded by director's chairs, lights, crew, and a television camera. Director Dunstan Steele turns from consulting with a lighting guy when a freshly made-up Pamela Murray steps in.
Hello! Oh, you look terrific. Are you ready to do this?
Thanks! Yeah.
What?
No buts. I'm just a little nervous.
Well, of course you are. That's fine. Use it. Nervous can work for you. Yeah, I tell you what. Do you trust me? Let's try some things. Have a sit down. Miss Murray needs a seat. Could I have a stool for her, please?
A production assistant brings in a stool.
Thank you. Now, sit down.
No, I'm okay. Really, I'm ready when you are.
You're ready, are you?
Yeah, I really am.
Uh-huh. Did you grow up in a big family?
Oh, I was the youngest of four.
The youngest? Are you sure you were wanted? Not just a mistake? I mean, maybe Daddy was so supposed to pull out and he didn't?
Maybe. I never really thought about it.
Oh, come on. You thought about it. You weren't wanted. You thought about it. You were a mistake. You should never have been born. You are the product of a dribble of sperm from your irresponsible sire and some of the worst luck since the woman who found the condom in her Vanderkamp beans.
Okay, look.
You don't belong on this earth. That dolly that you love, that dolly was supposed to be another little girl's dolly.
Mr. Steele, I don't think you...
Have I touched a nerve?
I'd really just like to do the commercial.
Oh, you would? Why should anyone care what you want? Your skin is repulsive. Ugh. Now, look into the camera and action.
I was so ashamed of my plaque psoriasis. I was hiding. I wore long sleeve sweaters in the middle of the hot Georgia summers, so I smell bad too. But since I found prescription Serenica, my skin is my proudest part.
Cut!
That was amazing.
No, it wasn't.
And cut! As we step out from the medicine. Oh, that was just one. If I can applaud for you
bravo,
both.
Bravo.
Just wonderful. Now.
Yes.
John, tell me why that wasn't wonderful.
Because she isn't any good.
Okay.
Now, Paula is a very nice person, and I look forward to having dinner with her, but she's devoid of talent, and simply we shouldn't be encouraging her.
Okay.
Paula, do you know any of those Sur La Table shops where they sell all sorts of kitchen equipment?
You could yes.
Get a job there. You do terribly well. You'd be very happy. Just drop out of the acting world now. Before things get even worse, all right?
Pots. You want pots? We got pots.
No point in going on trying, Paula. I'm afraid the jury has made its decision, and you just mustn't do this anymore. Sorry.
Ladles. You want ladles? We've got ladles.
Is there anything she can do? Can we? If she was cast in a production and you weren't allowed to fire her because she's the producer's daughter, what would you say to improve her?
I would say, let's go up this very tall tower here and admire the view.
Ladles, we got ladles.
That's good. There's no point auditioning for me. You have to audition for Sula Dove, all right?
But yeah. John, if I may say, you were fantastic in that script.
I felt
like a cold read, and yet you inhabited that director. You know, I didn't even notice Paul's performance, to be honest with you.
Well, that was what I was trying to do. I was trying to take the attention off her. So,
well, thank you for that.
Embarrassing as they eventually turned out.
Is there anything I could do?
Not in the world of acting, Paula. That's the whole point, you see. You are so fucking good. Basically, NFG, darling, and off you go.
All right, then. Well, thank you for that coaching. That has been a masterclass with actor John Cleese. Catches Why There Is No Hope Tour starting in Red Bank, New Jersey on October 7th, taking him through Hershey, Richmond, Denver, Phoenix, Tucson, San Jose, and ending in Santa Rosa, California on October 19th. You don't want to miss this Socratic dialogue and slideshow looking at dysfunctional elements of society, followed by a sit-down Q&A with the audience. For tickets, visit uniquelives.com/John-Cleese-America. John Cleese, everybody!
Yay! Oh, my gosh.
I have an urgent appointment now to watch the television. Can I go?
Absolutely.
Yes. Yay.
Lots of love. Bye.
Bye, John.
Bye, John.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Wow.
I think there's hope.
Coming up, what's better than Paul and me awkwardly crashing your next Zoom party? Well, lots of things are better, but that's what we're offering. We'll announce our new contest coming up after the break. Fun fact, since 1955, Mount Everest has grown 2.5 feet taller. Great, so now there's probably no way I can climb it. And we're back. Thank you, Lindsay Goodman. On the flute, the flautist. Hey, Paula Poundstone, this is an exciting night, isn't it? And it's not just because I'm still tingling from talking to John Cleese.
It is an exciting night. There's something in it for everyone. We are announcing our new contest. You can win a Zoom party with Paula Poundstone, that'll be me, and Adam Felber from Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, the comedy podcast, the one you're listening to. We're having a contest because when we just picked random listeners and offered them a Zoom party on a mutually agreed upon night, they said stuff like, why would I want that? I don't listen all that often, and I'm busy that night. So take a guess which one of my 10 cats stands on the refrigerator and cries at me every evening starting at 6 o'clock. Fill out the contest form with your guess at bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3. So it's bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3. Or that bit.ly link will be on our Facebook page. You can click on it and it'll take you to the form. You fill out the form with your guess of which cat stands on my refrigerator and yowls at me at 6 p.m. every night. The names of the people with the correct guess will be put in a drawing to win a Zoom party with me and Adam and up to 50 of your friends. By the way, nobody has 50 friends, so no one is judging. Have your guess in by October 25th. And only one guess per person, because otherwise you cheating fucks would just send in 10 different guesses with 10 different cat names, and we'll have none of it.
Do you have a list of cats, Paula?
Oh, I forgot the list of cats. Oh, okay, and then the other thing is you have to guess what the names of all 10 cats are.
No.
No, I'm kidding. All right, here's the list of cats. Harrison, Tonks, Mrs. Fezziwig, Nash, Theo, Severus, Hardy, ShamWow, Wednesday, and Lawson.
Wow. So, Paula, if I can recapture this or recapitulate it or just restate it, you're saying that if our fans want to enter this contest, they can do so on our Facebook page. But if they want to make it a lot less complicated, they simply have to type in bit.ly/NLTPPZOOM3, and then they can go get to the form there.
Is that less complicated? The one that's
no, it's way more complicated.
ly/NLTPPZOOM3. What if? No, it's not complicated at all. Adam, no. Adam.
Yes.
Adam. Yeah. What if John Cleese, you know, because he's kind of into cats, what if he guesses? And then we do a Zoom party with John Cleese and 50 of his friends, because I'll bet he does.
And I bet his friends are also some of the other pythons. It would be like the greatest thing that ever happened.
Oh, my God.
John, if you're listening, please tell John the answer.
Yeah. John, it's Fluffy. It's John. Type in Fluffy at bit.ly/NLTPPZOOM3.
But, John, if that's too easy for you, John, we know, and you want to make it challenging, that you could also just go to our Facebook page.
My concern about going to the Facebook page is that maybe Putin will enter the contest. And you know what?
Right.
I am not fucking doing it with Putin. I'm not. And 50 of his oligarchs. I'm not going to do it. Putin, it's Fluffy. Putin, guess Fluffy. It's Fluffy.
Hey, Paula, what's going on with your Poundstone product empire this week?
Oh, my gosh, Adam. Here at Poundstone Industries, also known as Lipstick Nancy Incorporated, we are striving to be the best company in the world to work for. We provide healthy meals for our employees.
I didn't forget your breakfast. I didn't bring your breakfast because you didn't eat your din-din.
And they, in turn, take care of our customers. Listeners can go to the store at my website, paulapoundstone.com, to purchase the very popular Poundstone Pussy Pillow, a 4.5-inch by 5-inch pillow stuffed with catnip and equipped with a grommet so you can tie a string to it and make it even more tantalizing for your cat. It has a cat joke printed on one side, and on the other side, I'm happy to autograph it to your cat. And you can always find my remarkably soft tri-poly blend t-shirt with my self-portrait on the left breast and a memorable quote on the back in both standard and baseball styles. If you click on the tour page at paulapoundstone.com, you can buy tickets to come see me in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the A.J. Fletcher Opera Theater on Thursday, October 21st, which is named after the character from Murder, She Wrote, or in Alexandria, Virginia, at the Birchmere, November 19th, 20th, and 21st, and in Tucson, Arizona, at the Fox Tucson Theater on Thursday, October 28th. There's so much more I could tell you, but Heidi.
Oh, Heidi. All right, and I just wanted to let everybody know that we're just a few weeks away from the release of my book with Charlie Band, Confessions of a Puppet Master, an exploration in B-movie madness happening in Hollywood from the 70s all the way through to today. By the way, we have a new blurb in, Paula. I'm pretty excited about this. Peter Sagal says... It's a blurb. Peter Sagal says, this book is a blast. It made me want to stay up all night and watch terrible movies.
That's a great blurb.
Yeah, sure is. Thanks, Peter. Anyway, subscribe to this podcast. It's free. You'll get it every week at no charge. If there's a subject or topic you'd like to know about, tell us at that address, nobodylistenstopaulapoundstone@gmail.com. Or you could go to a really complicated web address that Tony and Anita Hull set up. Anyway, that's our show. Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone is hosted by Paula Poundstone and yours truly, Adam the Felber. Special thanks to our guest, John Cleese.
Ooh.
Oh. Yay!
Yeah. And to our house band, Lindsay Goodman. You can find her at www.lindsaygoodman.com. Our show is produced by Paula Poundstone, Adam Felber, Bonnie Burns, Ken Lezebnik, and Tony Anita Hull. Star Burns production by Land Romo. Poundstone Industries production by Vic Lowry. Transcription services for the show provided by TranscribeMe, a premier internationally used transcription service. Use code Paula Poundstone when placing your order at transcribeme.com to receive an expedited service.
That's our show for tonight. Won't somebody please listen to me? You know, I don't think it's that complicated. It's bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3. So each thing has a meaning. I don't know what the first part means, but it's right. Bit.ly. But NLTPP.
Well, Bit.ly is an address shortening system, so that makes it can make your addresses easier.
Oh.
You bitched about the last one, Adam.
It would have been longer?
Yeah, it would have been longer.
Oh, this
would have been much longer.
Well, this, you know what? If I get another kitten, and I might, I'm going to name it bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3. That's the number 3, just so you know. bit.ly. So, like, if it's an outdoor cat, for example, which it won't be, but if it was, and I was caught, it was indoor, outdoor. bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3, the number 3. Kitty, 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 come on in.
Yeah, you know, she probably wouldn't come if you said that, but she might.
No, the problem is, while I held the door open calling, like, shitloads of things that don't belong in the house would have come in. Like axe murderers and possums and stuff. bit.ly/NLTPPZoom3. That's the number 3. Oh, fuck, there's a possum.
Snap Hands Audio, a podcast network.